of its territory, even if the referendum decides these regions are part of Russia. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joins us from Belgrade. And president at the European Institute for International Law and International Relations, Mahmoud Rafat, joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome. John Bosnich, first over to you. So you're having this announcement made in terms of the referendums, Donbass republics, whether they will join Russia or not. I think the results are pretty clear at this point of what's going to happen, I think, if you agree. If they do join Russia, or if they don't, tell us what you think, especially when it comes to the recognition by the international community or the lack of it. And then the question comes up, is that even required given the landscape right now?
Well, first of all, we can expect that the referenda will be in favor of joining Russia. These regions of Ukraine have been under military attack by the Ukrainian government, in effect by their own government, since 2014. These military actions against the civilian populations of these regions have been based on anti-Russian sentiment. It coupled with the support of NATO for the entry of Ukraine into the NATO alliance as a belligerent power against Russia. So we could expect that the referenda will be overwhelmingly pro-Russian and that these referenda are actually quite long overdue, given the fact that the people there have made it clear they have no intention to be a part of Ukraine in the future.
So if we want to take a look at this, Mahmoud Rafat, in terms of the people, what John Bosnich said, since 2014, they've been the subject and the target of these bombardments coming from the Ukrainian government. So you have a referendum that, as our guest there said, and I said in the intro, most likely anticipate them to become part of Russia. What are we looking at in terms of the rights of these people in particular, and then their republics as a whole? Are we looking at the fact that they are required, or the international community is required, to recognize this? Of course, the U.S. and the West are simply dismissing this.
Well, firstly, let me agree with my colleague from Belgrade. Yes, these people, this population sector, more pro-Russia. But we have some elements in the international community. We cannot overcome that when it comes to the separation and secession of regions, especially these regions would join another country, still did not achieve a final victory in the war in order to put its conditions, but temporary, it's way winning the war somehow, despite the Ukrainian attack back last few days and getting back some of its land, but still, the upper hand in Ukraine for Russia, for sure. Concerning the recognition of the international community, it's expected to be like Crimea. Crimea, until now, since 2014, until today, the international community did not recognize Crimea as a Russian department or as Russian region, despite there was a referendum. But this recognition, with the time, which pass, I mean, with the years, long years when it passed, it will has no real effect, will not has real physical effect on the ground. the physical effect on the ground. Will these regions, if there are a referendum passed, and it's very highly expected to pass, with yes to Russia, these regions will be Russian. So this recognition is very theoretical thing, and the international law is not real effective element.
Well, John Busnich, and just as last question on this issue about the referendum, so we can move on to other aspects of this. If the people say that they want to be connected to Russia, or be part of Russia, given the fact that we hold that to be authentic, then what right does the U.S. or any other country have to impose its will on the residents of these areas, that this is what they want? I mean, how can they impose their will on these people?
Of course, the United States has no business whatsoever in this affair, except having been the people who conducted an illegal coup d'etat to remove the elected president of Ukraine at the beginning of this entire crisis. So America provoked this situation. Russia exercised an incredible degree of patience, not doing anything directly in the territory for a matter of 8 years. And there was some statement earlier on your program about objections from the West about declarations of independence and declarations of affiliation during a conflict, but that's how the United States' own Declaration of Independence was issued, during the middle of a conflict with England. So they set the precedent for this. They set the precedent for war. And in fact, the most important factor here in this matter of a referendum for joining Russia is that if the referendum passes, if Russia accepts the referendum and recognizes the territory as part of Russia, it frees the hands of the Russian government to greatly increase its military operations in defense of what it will claim to be its own territory. That is a very important factor here. Up until now, it's been a special military operation. After a declaration of joining Russia that is approved by the Russian government, it will be a matter of defending Russian territory against foreign attackers. In those circumstances, the kid gloves are off, and there is no limit to the weaponry or the troops or the deployment of equipment that Russia could authorize. None whatsoever.
Mahmoud Rafat, do you think that that's what's going to happen in terms of the way the Russian stance is going to be? Or are we looking at the fact that Russia may, I'm just asking you to speculate here, may say, okay, we kind of got what we want regarding this territory, then there's now a chance for us, or maybe now is the time to look for peace? Or will that not happen and for Russia to continue with his offensive, so to speak?
Well, in my opinion, President Putin is planning now to end this war by cutting Ukraine, as the West decided to arm and to equip Ukraine with a huge quantity of arms. President Putin did not change his strategy or his original plan, but he employed plan B, in my opinion, which I expect to be cutting Russia, because let's remember the main reason of the war. The main reason of the Russian invasion to Ukraine is the question of joining the NATO. And joining the NATO, Russia takes it as a big threat to Moscow, as there will be military equipment on the NATO, as there will be radios, there will be listening equipment, etc. And that Russia took it as a big threat since the beginning, and that is the main reason of the war. So cutting Ukraine into parts with this method President Putin is employing now will leave a big space between Kiev and Moscow. So the Ukraine, if it's cut with this way President Putin is going on today, in my opinion, Ukraine will not be eligible enough to join the NATO in the future, in the short term. It's what will need decades to build economy and to build the military situation. And, sure. And so that will take a long time. In my opinion, President Putin is employing this plan today. Again, just let me reconfirm something. In the international law, these territories, once they join Russia, the international law will not have real arms against Russia here. And Russia for sure will treat them as region of Moscow. That means will defend them with all its power, among this power, the nuclear, if they are attacked or they are threatened, because there will be Russian territories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to wait and see how that will pan out in terms of how Russia is going to position itself, if it hasn't already, when it comes to, let's say, nuclear weapons. However, still confused here, John Busnish, about the stance of Russia when it comes to peace. Now, we know that the Russian president has said as of the 20th of September, peaceful solution to the Ukraine crisis currently not possible. That's what Putin had said. But then you have Turkey that said, no, Putin wants to end this war. And I think the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi also had spoken to the Russian president and said that, yeah, it looks like it's a good time for you to end it, and getting some positive impression from him on that. But other news, basically not really clear on this. What do you think?
Well, I think it's pretty clear now that Russia has proven that it can take whatever territory in Ukraine it wants to take, except that it wants to keep the cost of this operation down, not just for the Russian army, but for the Ukrainian people, because Russia continues, and the Russian people continue to see the Ukrainian people as a brother nation that has effectively been misled and kidnapped by a fake government placed in power by an illegal coup. So Russia is hedging its bets in many ways here. Number one, it no longer needs any authorization to raise the level of its military activity. And number two, once part of the former Ukraine becomes an officially declared part of Russia, not just Crimea, but the rest, the southern part of Nova Russia, or New Russia, once it becomes a part of Russia proper, then those areas and Ukraine as a whole are no longer eligible for joining NATO or the EU, because the rules of both NATO and the EU, as my fellow commentator tonight has noted, require that the government which wants to join those organizations must control its entire territory, which it already does not in Crimea, and which it most certainly will not do once the southeastern part of the country is declared a part of Russia. And this is a checkmate move for the West, and if the West sees itself being checkmated, they might, as a last-ditch option, attempt to enter into real peace negotiations. But Russia holds all the cards.
There was a point where Zelensky's tenure was in doubt, Mahmoud Rafat. And this goes back months ago, where there was a concerted effort by him to want to have a peaceful solution to this, to try to go into mediation. But yet we had it being countered by the likes of the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, if you recall, who said now is not the time, you don't have that directive as of yet. If this referendum takes place, and once it does, and the republics become part of Russia, do you think that he will be told to continue this war, even if he doesn't want to? Do you think that he may want to opt for peace at this point? How do you see it?
Well, I think somehow the U.S. administration now wants this war to continue as long as possible in order to get Russia pay all type of costs possible. It means from its army, from soldiers, from the equipment, financially and economically. But honestly, President Putin, we saw him leading this war very differently. The West did not expect President Putin to lead this war on this way and to attain this chain of success, especially economically, because the economy was the main approach of the West to get Russia and President Putin hurt him. While Putin led that in a different way, and that now the Russian ruble got increased dramatically, while the euro shut down dramatically in front of the US dollar, which made everything heavy on the West and attained success for the Russian side. The Americans are far away from the area, and that's why they are feeling safe, and everything for them is safe. That's why the administration of President Biden, who, in my opinion, launched this war since the beginning, wants this war to continue and to continue and to continue. Either President Putin wanted to end the war by cutting these three regions, Luhansk, Donetsk, and Kherson, and end the war after that, I think the administration of President Biden will push forward for this war to continue under pretext to get these territories back at least, which will be impossible, as we just mentioned, or any other pretext, just the war to continue.
Yeah, while you were speaking, John Bosnich, our guest there, was speaking, I was looking at the table here of the temperatures, local time and weather in capitals across Europe to see how warm or cold it was, looking down the road as to whether how cold some of these European capitals are going to get during the wintertime. So if we were having this conversation, let's say in January, which is just a few months down the road if the war were to continue, do you think that the U.S. could still tell, let's say, Germany, listen, you got to continue funding it, or tell the U.K. or tell any other of these European countries, continue this war, we need to win?
Well, if they try to do that, and it's not beyond the United States to do that, because they tend to dictate to every country around the world, even to my native Canada, which is their closest ally. So if the United States attempts to dictate to Europe to continue a war which is immediately on Europe's doorstep, while they're freezing in the dark in sub-zero temperatures, I think what the United States will do is it will score the biggest own goal against its own empire since World War II. The EU will shatter. Several EU states near Ukraine will consider neutrality. And Germany will say, why should we fight this war for America when we could have found a peace with Russia? And that would be a real death knell for the Anglo-American empire, because it is a projection of the English forces and the American forces across Europe. And I just don't think that Europe is going to put up with it anymore. This is the way things end when you push things too far.
And how do you see it, Mahmoud Rafat, looking down the road, especially in the wintertime, where all eyes, I'm sure, of the European officials are trying to prepare for rescue packages of any kind in order to make up for the shortages that they're going to be facing. At this point, when you talk about a few months, that's going to come up real quickly. Do you think the war will last, as you said, it's going to continue, will last up to the wintertime, and do you think that they're going to be able to withstand it then if the U.S. leads them into wanting to continue this war?
Well, let's just remind of very important point. The European policies and political life since the end of Second World War, I mean the Western Europe, is following the United States somehow completely, especially when it comes to Russian or even from the Soviet Union period until today. It's following the United States and the real planner of the United States. And we have been seeing each time there was European leader wanted to make European army, what happened to him. We saw when President Emmanuel Macron of France wanted to build European army in order to have a little independence politically from the United States, what happened to him and the yellow vests and lots of troubles. Also, the German counselor, Helmut Kohl, also when he wanted or just thought about the idea. So there is no way in all cases for Europe to have its independent situation 100%. It will be still influenced by United States. In my opinion, the situation will be highly aggravated and will be dramatically bad in the winter, in the war. And today, I think President Putin will penalize funding and arming Ukraine. He will not let that down that easily. He must be compensated with very high price. And this politics, this kind of politics, democratic follow, especially democratic, I mean, the President Obama, when he pushed also Europe to put sanctions on Russia in 2014 because of Crimea, we saw Russia in the Middle East and putting its knife in the stomach of Europe from the Middle East and for the first time to reach the warm water. Today, these sanctions posed by Europe on Ukraine, on Russia, are shutting down almost the euro and making a real messy in the social life, economic life, maybe will freeze the industry in Europe. So this is really catastrophic approach and road if we continue and if not to stop and to make real negotiations for peace.
Well, it's interesting, John Bostich. Our guest there says that Europe has to abide by what the U.S. pretty much is saying. Now, if I'm European officials and I'm sitting at my capitals looking at the war itself, following the U.S., lead, looking at the U.S.'s report card militarily, going back to the wars, well, let's see, how did the U.S. do in Afghanistan? Didn't win that war. How did the U.S. do in Syria? Didn't win that one either. Iraq? No. I can't remember the last time the U.S. did win a war. So there's not much to go by. And if I'm a European official or president or what have you, then that's not a very good success rate, obviously. On the other hand, as our guest there said, in terms of the economies, they're getting battered, okay? So why are they what incentive would they have to continue? Is the U.S. scaremongering them into saying, hey, Ukraine now, you could be next?
Absolutely. That is the basic American approach. Threatening Europe with plans on Russia's part that Russia has no plans of whatsoever. Russia defended itself in Ukraine. This was a step too far by the Western alliance, moving into really and truly the historical and cultural heartland of Russia, potentially placing nuclear weapons 3 to 5 minutes away from Moscow. It was impossible for Russia to accept this. It was amazing that Putin took as long as he did to intervene. It means that he attempted every possible negotiation. He went through the Minsk process. Those accords were broken, and now it's time to call the game quits. Russia is calling the game quits. It's saying this is Russian territory. It will be reaffirmed by the people in a referendum. And if the West wants to attack Russia, then anywhere in the world that the West is present militarily becomes a target. And we know that Russia's missiles are fast enough and completely impregnable to attack from the Western forces. Okay. So it could mean a complete annihilation of Western forces around Ukraine.
We'll end it on that. Thank you very much, John Bostich from Belgrade, journalist, activist, and political analyst. A pleasure. Thank you. Mahmoud Rafat, president of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tapway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
spread of modern-day slavery. In this special program, we examine the problem of modern-day slavery, which affects tens of millions of people worldwide. Despite the fact that traditional slavery was abolished towards the end of the 19th century, nonetheless, slavery exists today, albeit in a different form, and tens of millions of people are affected by it. Please stay with us for more. But what is modern-day slavery? Trafficking in persons, human trafficking, and modern slavery are used as umbrella terms to refer to both sex trafficking and compelled labor or forced labor. Modern slavery is the severe exploitation of other people for personal or commercial gain. Modern slavery is all around us, but often just out of sight. People can become entrapped making our clothes, serving our food, picking our crops, working in factories, working in houses as cooks or cleaners, etc. From the outside, it can look like a normal job, but people are being controlled. They can face violence or threats or be forced into inescapable debt. But what is the most common form of modern slavery today? The most common form of modern slavery is bonded labor or debt bondage. Debt bondage is a form of forced labor and happens when a person is forced to work to pay off a debt. They are tricked into working for little or no pay at all, with no control over their debt. This is thought to be the most widespread form of modern-day slavery today. Some people are forced to work in mines or farms and receive little or no pay. Statistics show that modern slavery is very prevalent in some countries, with large numbers of people effectively working as slaves. Generally speaking, in countries where there is a lack of legislation, or the legislation has many loopholes and is weak, or where there is widespread corruption, or countries where laws are simply not enforced, we see the problem of modern-day slavery. Generally, the poorer sections of the population, or those who are not protected by the laws of the land, fall prey to modern-day slavery. Iranian journalist and writer Mohammad Dowlati defines modern slavery as, if a person is forced to work for little or no pay, possibly under very difficult circumstances, and other people benefit from this forced labor, and there is no way that person can escape from this predicament, then that person is a modern-day slave. Another aspect of modern slavery, which is not common knowledge, is that this phenomena has spread to many industrialized and developed countries, as well as developing nations and underdeveloped countries. For example, in Britain, an industrialized nation, there are at least 10,000 individuals who are classified as modern-day slaves. In fact, in virtually all Western nations who claim to champion human rights today, we see the problem of modern slavery in all of its different shapes and forms. One notable example is immigrant workers, mostly from Latin America, who work as seasonal labor in American farms, and in particular in the state of California. These immigrant workers are exploited heavily, receiving very little money for their work, and are often threatened with deportation from the United States. Another notable example is the trafficking of Eastern European women and girls to various countries in Western Europe, working as prostitutes and sex slaves. Sex trafficking from Eastern to Western Europe may also occur through a specific form of coercion, whereby individuals are compelled to continue in prostitution through the use of unlawful debt, purportedly incurred through their transportation, recruitment, or even their sale, which exploiters insist they must pay off before they can be set free. Another form of modern-day slavery is sex trafficking. Forced prostitution is another form of modern-day slavery, which we see most often in Western nations, particularly in Western Europe, North America, Eastern Europe, and Southeast Asia. The latest United Nations report called Global Estimates of Modern Slavery, published by the International Labour Organization, ILO, International Organization for Migration, IOM, and International Human Rights Group, Walk Free, revealed last year some 50 million people were living in modern slavery, 28 million of them in forced labor, and 22 million in forced marriages. According to the International Labor Organization's Director General, Guy Ryder, "It is shocking that the situation of modern slavery is not improving. Nothing can justify the persistence of this fundamental abuse of human rights." Compared to 2016 global estimates, 10 million more people were in modern slavery in 2021, with women and children disproportionately vulnerable. According to the United Nations report, modern slavery occurs in almost every country in the world and cuts across ethnic, cultural, and religious lines. And, of course, in industrialized and developed nations, we see this phenomena very clearly. More than half of all forced labor and quarter of all forced marriages can be found in upper middle income or high income countries. 86% of forced labor cases are found in the private sector, with forced commercial sexual exploitation representing 23%, almost 4 out of 5 victims of whom are females. Forced labor is another form of modern-day slavery. Forced labor, sometimes also referred to as labor trafficking, is when a person uses force or physical threats, psychological coercion, abuse of the legal process, deception, or other coercive means to compel someone else to work. Once a person's labor is exploited by such means, the person's prior consent to work for an employer is legally irrelevant. The employer is a trafficker, and the employee is a trafficking victim. Migrants around the world are particularly vulnerable to this form of human trafficking. But individuals also may be forced into labor in their own countries. Female victims of forced or bonded labor, especially women and girls in domestic servitude, are often sexually abused or exploited as well. Another unsavory aspect of modern-day slavery is forced child labor. Although children may legally engage in certain forms of work, children can also be found in slavery or slavery-like situations. Some indicators of forced labor of a child include situations in which the child appears to be in the custody of a non-family member who requires the child to perform work that financially benefits someone outside of the child's family and does not offer the child the option of leaving the work, such as forced begging. Yet another aspect of modern-day slavery is unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers in wars around the world. Child soldiering is a manifestation of human trafficking when it involves the unlawful recruitment or use of children through the use of force, fraud or coercion by armed forces as combatants or other forms of labour. Perpetrators may be government armed forces, paramilitary organisations or rebel groups around the world. Many children are forcibly abducted to be used as combatants in all sorts of wars and conflicts around the world.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Venise, along with military attaches from different embassies, to attend this ceremony dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
Time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire, we renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi-imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Amid international calls for renewing the UN brokered truce, the Yemeni Center for Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to release a report titled The Alleged Truce. The report highlights the Saudi-led coalition's violations of the UN agreement since it was brokered in April.
Saudi Arabia's violations were committed from the first day of the war, but they continued even under the UN truce. The most important violations were the non-compliance with the terms of the truce, which included reducing the number of scheduled flights and specifying only one destination instead of two, as well as the continued detention of fuel ships. There is a breach on the essence of the agreement.
The report says the Saudi-led coalition has committed over 14,000 violations, including waging 278 airstrikes, which led to the death of Yemeni civilians.
As a human rights center, we affirm that the most important violations are the loss of life. Unfortunately, during the truce, 70 Yemeni civilians, including women and children, were killed. The siege has also continued during the truce. This has caused the deaths of thousands of civilians due to the lack of fuel in hospitals.
Recently, the UN Security Council urged warring sides in Yemen to extend the truce, saying it has had tangible benefits for the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. So far, there are no signs of agreement from both parties.
A complete end to the war and siege is what Yemenis are demanding from the international community, including the United Nations. They say the temporary truce should not be extended since the world body has failed to ensure its full implementation.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carber was behind the wheel of a car, hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street, before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include that the police who stopped Chris on that fateful day may have known who was inside the car in the lead-up to the fatal shooting. This is, of course, all being investigated, but the protest organisers have made absolutely clear that they are going to refuse to back down until the demands of the family are met and justice be served.
Fighting back the tears, family members spoke of their ordeal after seeing the body for the first time since the killing. News of the shooting has caused uproar, especially in the black community. They feel this was just another example of a racist system out to harm them. Following the backlash, the officer responsible for the shooting has been suspended. An investigation is also underway, but the police watchdog warned it could take 9 months to reach a conclusion. The family expressed anger at the lengthy wait. However, the question of race playing a role will be examined as a factor, providing some small hope that the family's demands will be answered. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinian protesters took to the streets in the blockaded Gaza Strip following the Friday prayers to condemn Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied city of Al-Quds. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime, vowing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The protest comes following the desecration of the mosque by Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces. The mosque is the third holiest site in Islam. Hamas resistance movement has warned the Israeli regime against violating the sanctity of Al-Quds.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line that mustn't be crossed. We hold the Zionist entity fully responsible for any attack in Al-Quds. The enemy will only open the gates of hell on itself. The continuation of attacks on the sanctity of Al-Quds will backfire on the Zionist entity and its settlers.
Israeli settlers regularly storm Al-Aqsa Mosque, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. The attacks and desecration of the mosque compound increased during Jewish holidays.
We salute our people in Al-Quds and we say to them that Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza will not remain silent amid Israeli attacks on Al-Quds. We also call on all Palestinians and Muslims to mobilize to confront Israel's conspiracies against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians have raised the alarm over Tel Aviv's plots to divide Al-Aqsa Mosque into Jewish and Muslim sections or sitting times for visits.
The Zionists have no right to be in Al-Aqsa Mosque because it's purely for Muslims since ancient times. They are trying to control Al-Aqsa Mosque, but all their attempts will be in vain.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. Observers say the world has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against the oppressed people of Palestine for decades.
Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Iranians across the country have commemorated Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. People in the capital, Tehran, marked the occasion, too, by walking southward to the town of Frey. That was a symbolic walk by those who could not take part in the Arba'in march held in Iraq, where pilgrims from across the world marched toward the city of Karbala, which houses the holy shrine of Imam Hussein.
I'm so sad that I couldn't visit the holy shrine of Imam Hussein this year, but I took part in this walk in Tehran to play my part in preserving the legacy of Imam Hussein.
This is a march for all of the freedom seekers, no matter what their religion is. Imam Hussein sacrificed his life 14 centuries ago to save our religion, so this could be a lesson for all people to uphold righteousness, even if it comes at the cost of their lives.
Imam Hussein is the third Shia Imam and the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. The Shia Imam and his companions were killed by the tyrant of their time, Yazid, during the Battle of Karbala some 14 centuries ago. Every year, on the occasion of Arba'in, millions of pilgrims from different countries travel on foot to get to Imam Hussein's shrine. The march is meant to sympathize with the Imam on the pains he endured during the Battle of Karbala.
To us Muslims, participating in the Arba'in march in Karbala is more than a religious duty, but a passion for preserving Imam Hussein's ideology and promoting it among the new generation.
Imam Hussein and his companions were martyred after they refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, for they believed he did not practice Islam, as taught by the Prophet Muhammad.
As Imam Hussein said, he rose against Yazid to revive true Islam as introduced by the Prophet Muhammad, who was Imam Hussein's grandfather. By his refusal to pay allegiance to Yazid, our Imam exposed the fact that Yazid was not treading the path of Islam.
This year, from Iran alone, some 3.5 million people took part in the Arba'in walk in Iraq, in a show of respect for Imam Hussein, who is known among Muslims as a symbol of resistance against tyranny. To Muslims, the Arba'in walk is of key importance. These people couldn't make it to Karbala this year, but they felt bound to take part in this symbolic march, for they believe by doing this, they would help preserve the legacy of Imam Hussein. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Like the other parts of the Muslim world, Pakistan Shia Muslims observe Arba'in with traditional reverence and solemnity. Thousands of mourners march in streets of Pakistan to pay tribute to Imam Hussein, the grandson of Holy Prophet Muhammad, who embraced martyrdom in Karbala in southern Iraq some 1400 years ago. The battle was fought between the faithful followers of the third Shia Imam, Hussein bin Ali, and Yazidi forces on the plains outside the modern Iraqi city of Karbala, which is home to Imam's shrine, a sacred sanctuary for Shia Muslims.
We believe the legacy of Imam Hussein is a timeless source of lessons about humanity and loyalty that exceeded his time and place. The love for Imam is endless and will continue until the end of this world.
The Islamic New Year, started from the month of Muharram, has been observed all over Pakistan with great dedication. Muharram is the month of mourning for the lovers and faithful followers of Imam Hussein.
We're here to pay tribute to Imam Hussein, his family and his companions who sacrificed their lives to save Islam. The mission of Imam Hussein is the mission of truth, peace and justice.
Similar mourning processions and religious gatherings were held in all major cities and towns all across Pakistan with special security arrangements.
The mourners and religious scholars have highlighted the teachings of Imam Hussein and his uprising against Yazid in Karbala. They regard the tragedy of Karbala as the symbol of resistance against oppressors. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Every year, millions of pilgrims from all over the world take part in the Arba'in march in Iraq, walking the distance between the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. In this religious gathering, pilgrims commemorate the third Shia Imam, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, who's a symbol of love and sacrifice. Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in southern Iraq in the 7th century after fighting chivalrously for justice and resisting succumbing to the tyrant of his era. The modern example of Imam Hussein's resilience against oppression is Palestine. On the way of the pilgrims marching to Holy Karbala, a monument incarnating Al-Aqsa Mosque grabs pilgrims' attention. There is a convoy named the Al-Aqsa Corps, which receives thousands of pilgrims from various countries during Arba'een. Al-Aqsa Corps convoy forges a direct link between the oppression inflicted upon Imam Hussein and the one suffered by the Palestinian people in the face of the Zionist regime.
Undoubtedly, the issue of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his oppression is similar to the current oppression against the Palestinian nation. This nation is facing organized terrorism, which is led and carried out by Israel, the fundamental enemy of Islam and Muslims. Therefore, we say the plight of Palestinians is very similar to the story of Karbala. If you want to rise to the aid of the Palestinian cause, we must rise from the origins of the movement of Imam Hussein.
What's happening in Palestine today refreshes the memories of what took place around 1400 years ago. The oppression Palestinians are suffering at the hands of Israeli occupying forces is today's version of Imam Hussein's resistance against the second Umayyad caliph, Yazid.
Palestinian people, since a century, are facing a war from the imperialism and Zionism, ethnic cleansing, killing women, children, massacres, many massacres were made in Palestine, in Palestinian villages, and prisoners. 1 million Palestinians went to prison since in the past 30 years. 1 million. So Palestine today is Karbala of today, of this time.
Within the big tent that belongs to Palestinians is an exhibition that displays photos of Palestinian martyrs killed by Israeli forces. This, alongside other organized activities, has attracted the attention of younger generations.
As our leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei says, the liberation of Quds will begin from Palestine with God's help. God willing, nothing can hinder us, Iraqis and the Arab and Muslim community in general. We gather around the axis of Hussein, peace being upon him. Today in the Arba'een Walk and in this mawqif, it was shown that Hussein's saga is being honored by our Palestinian brothers. This is a clear reason that depicts the universal aspect of Imam Hussein, showing that he is not specific to a particular sect or religion or group. He's for everyone.
One of the lessons learned from Imam Hussein's revolution is that death with dignity is better than a life with humiliation. And the resistance demonstrated by the brave Palestinian nation in the face of Israeli crimes and oppression is actually similar to that.
Every year during Arba'een, we are reminded that the lovers of justice and liberation from oppression are in the majority. And this mawqif is trying to educate people about the atrocities against the Palestinian people and to teach especially the younger generation what the Palestinian cause is. Mahdi Abbasian, Karbala.
Miles covered on foot. Mourners walked from their homes all the way to the city center in Karachi to join the main procession to show their love for Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam.
Mourners have gathered here to commemorate the 40th day after the anniversary of Imam Hussein's martyrdom and to show their respect for a man who sacrificed his life but did not pledge allegiance to the tyrant of his time, Yazid.
The mourners chanted, "Stand like Hussein against Yazid of your time."
People, you are looking there, there are a large amount of people here. People love Imam Hussein. This is the day which the family of Imam Hussein came from Sham to Karbala.
It's a lesson for many because his sacrifices for Islam and what he has done is something we should remember for all of our lives.
Abu Abdullah sacrificed for the
Islam, for the people of Islam, for the people of the world, for the peace, for the humanity, for the justice.
The mourners recited elegies to remember the hardships of Prophet's grandson and the tragedy of Karbala and protest against tyrants of the time.
We are here to tell the oppressors that we are not a minority. We are a majority here. And we always prove them wrong every year in Arbaeen. Every year this day we prove them wrong that we are a minority. We are the biggest majority in the world and we will stay the biggest majority.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sacrificed his life and his family for this save the Islam, the message of Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and become the voice of the voiceless people of humanity.
It is still relevant because it was such a great sacrifice on his part, because he sacrificed his family, his children, for the sake of our religion, for the sake of Allah. So for that reason, it is really relevant to us.
Those who participated in the mourning ceremony say they are inspired by Imam Hussein's philosophy of freedom. His devotees and die-hard followers believe his legacy will remain a ray of hope for ages to come. Until then, millions across the globe will keep flocking Karbala to refresh their allegiance with their Imam. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Signs of Justice. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the signs of justice in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the topic of justice and we see that Islam is emphasizing on justice, therefore we need to look at the signs as well. That what are the signs? When can we say that a person is observing justice? Because we have different meanings of justice. Some people in today's world, especially those are following the capitalism and the socialism, they have made their own definition of justice. And whatever is in their own favor, they call it justice. And if anything goes against them, they don't call it as justice. And they call it as something which is unfair. But we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he had made different governors and he sent them to different states, he has basically advised them and told them about the signs of